Hey, it is Bob, and this is a very special, I always say that, right? But it's a special Bob Saget's here for you, because I have an old friend. He's not old, but I'm older than him, but I've known him a really long time, like 40 years, something crazy, right? It's George Lopez, and it's exciting because this is also my first show of my podcast as I've moved over to ATC, All Things Comedy, where George is as well with his amazing podcast, Oh My God, Hi. And I just adore this man. He's one of my favorite stand-ups for a very long time. I've known him a very long time. You know him from all of his television shows. He has a new television show that he's about to start work on. We're going to talk to him about it. And you know what to do with his podcast. That sounds like I'm going to tell you to shove it, but I'm not. You rate, review, you subscribe, you follow. If you're on, I don't know what you're on, mushrooms? No, but you could be on Spotify, or you could be probably on Apple or Stitcher or Twatcher or Klitcher, Donner and Blinson. That was in my promo too, because I'm recording promos because I go across the board now with All Things Comedy. That's what we do when we become part of a family. And Bill Burr just got me in a headlock and said, actually, he had his legs around my neck in a wrestling move. And I said, yes. Actually, I went, because I couldn't hear myself because he had his very strong Bill Burr. Anyway, I am just thrilled to be continuing this podcast in a bigger way, I think. And I love doing it before. I have nothing but positive things to say about my previous peeps, but I am really happy. And I'll be calling people as well and see how you guys are doing, like I used to do. Once or twice a month, I'll be calling and you guys, I'll give you a number to call. I'll announce it on Twitter or on Instagram stories and say, hey, call this number and I'll give you a holler on a certain day, on a certain time. And so we'll do that again. But I also look forward to many, many more guests and never ending. I'm never going to stop doing this damn thing because I really love it. Mark my words. Why do people say that? How can you mark someone's words? I guess it's like giving notes. You just mark their words. I am now checking to see if George has asked to be admitted. That's what they say when you check into a hospital. I'd like to be admitted. That's really clever, Bob. Please don't say things like that. I love hearing, sometimes I hear Norm MacDonald's voice in my head. Saget, you can be funnier than that. Why'd you do that? It's just another pun. And it's true. Recently, I had Eddie Izzard on my show, and you know, she told me do puns because they're not universal. And so I try not to, but I can't help it. I was kind of raised by Groucho and dad jokes and dick jokes. And by the way, my conversation with George will probably have some F-bombs in it because we talk as we talk. I love this man. He is an incredibly special talent, comedian, actor, major podcaster. It's really... He's just special. I have to find out the many meanings of the word chingon. I don't speak Spanish, so I'm going to get some help. And maybe we can just list George Carlin's 7 words in Spanish, which would be an honor for me if we can go that far. So with no further ado, here is my old pal, George Lopez. Here he comes. George, I am so happy to do this. I know you're busy as hell. Holy crap.
When did you start doing your podcast?
I started 118 episodes ago, so that would be back in the 50s.
Oh, shit.
I started, there she is.
My daughter, Mayan.
Mayan's about to be a TV star. Hi, Mayan. That's nice. I watched that on camera. That's that. Go to YouTube. Go to YouTube.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
1979 at the Comedy Store in Westwood.
We did, and we got stories that we can't tell you. But I'm excited. You got a real show. You got a major thing happening.
No, we do. It was wonderful. We did an interview together last year for TikTok over Latino Heritage Month, and the writer, our showrunner, Debbie Wolf, saw something in us that could be something special in the show. And turns out she's, you know, co-executive producer of The Conners and worked with Bruce Helford, who co-created George Lopez. Hey, and
how did you hear about Full House the first time?
I was asked to do it, but I was on a show on CBS called The Morning Program. But then I got fired from that. And then my manager called Jeff Franklin, the producer, and said, Bob's available. So they let go of another guy, which was sad. And then they brought me in.
Do you know that, is that the one that Letterman did, like the morning guys did? Did Letterman do that one?
No, that mine was, Letterman did his own show on NBC that didn't last, but it was cool as hell. It got really cool. And then did this thing. Oh, but I wanted to tell Mayan congratulations again.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's Lopez versus Lopez, yes, and it's for NBC.
Yes.
And it's also your dad's the exec producer, which you'll be fighting for eventually. He'll have to give
I'm a producer and a writer.
Oh, you are? You are. So you're co-EPs on this thing?
Yes, sir.
What a good dad. I would never give my kids that money.
He's like, you know, it's the biggest compliment. He's like, I wouldn't be doing this with you if I didn't think that you could stand next to me and be just as good as I am.
I didn't say that, did I?
Yeah, you did. I remember the details. Well,
I am thrilled, and it's NBC, and it's really nice to see you.
But
I think, you know, I met her when she was a little thing.
I think so. You know, interestingly enough, man, when people would start to see your stand-up, I remember they would be like, this guy is like, you know, they would say raunchy. You know, they'd go, he's nothing like he is on America's Funniest Home Videos. Man, this guy's raunchy. They loved it. But it was so unexpected from you,
right,
that it became the... It was, you know, there's a few things that shock people other than seeing a guy do America's Funniest Home Videos and then go seeing him at a club and he's completely opposite than what you see there.
It's really weird. And I'm sure that, you know, and people are over it now. Now they come to see whatever. They love those family shows and God knows people want them again in some way just to help us get through this insanity. But you also, all those years of the George Lopez show, you were doing, you know, it was all family stuff. That's what you always made, these wonderful family shows.
But do you know, I saw Mark Curry outside of the Improv when my show was first starting. You know, he was doing Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
Right. We had the same producer, actually, Full House in that.
Yeah. So I remember seeing him, and it was really kind of, you know, middle of the road, and it was just kind of laying there. And I remember I saw him outside and I said, hey, so you decided to keep it clean, huh? And he's like, yeah, you know, I'm on that kid show. It's family friendly. And I don't want them to see me be adult in the club because, you know, I have the family friendly show. And then when I drove home, I remember driving up Melrose to like Highland. And then I was thinking like, well, fuck, you know, I don't want to do that.
No.
I said, I think if I'm going to get my show, I'll do the family show, but I don't want people to come and see me and be tied to this thing that I'm not connected to.
It's not you. You can't be not you. And you never were. I haven't had a chance to connect with you. I mean, I want to go golfing with you, frankly.
Oh, fucking hey, man.
Because I don't have clubs, so I actually want to use you, your body. But thank you for laughing at that. You've known me a long time. But I just couldn't. I always had a weird sense of humor. My stand-up was always demented. And then I got a show. I got fired from the CBS show because they said I was too hot for morning TV, or whatever that means.
And what did you do what did you do on that CBS show? Did you do stories or interviewers?
I was the third sidekick. So I was Marriott Hartley, Rollin Smith. It was when CBS made the mistake of giving the morning to the entertainment division rather than CBS News. And everybody was mad at the news division. And it only lasted 9 months, but I got kicked out in 5. And then Full House was a gift. I had a new baby. You know the deal of what we all went through. And I was happy to do it. And I loved doing Fuller House for Netflix. That was, it's an acting part, you know. And I have that ability. You have that ability. When you're with Mayan, you love her. You don't go around cursing at her.
Right.
But in your stand-up, I haven't even gotten a chance to tell you that, and you know this, but you are one of the best stand-ups. You are one of my favorite stand-ups, and I never really, I don't think I've fawned over you long enough.
Well, you know, that was a thing, you know, when we're doing the benefits for your sister that, like, I was just in, man, because, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you as a performer, but also as like a friend, man, knowing somebody from way back then,
mm-hmm.
and respecting you and your kindness even then, that I don't lose those things, man. Like I remember everybody that's kind, and I remember everybody that was considerate. And in stand-up, those are the two things that people lose first.
You're right. You're right. They go up. And you always showed up, and you just were so wonderful and so loving and so funny, which is also important during all this stuff. And you have your George Lopez Foundation.
Yeah.
And you're helping kids, and you got your camp. You got the Painted Turtle camp.
Yep, Painted Turtle.
And just to explain to people how they can get connected with that and what that is.
Well, you know, the Painted Turtle is the George Lopez Foundation, you know, on Instagram and on Twitter. But, you know, like culturally, we didn't go to the doctor growing up, you know, and I wet the bed from the dresser.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
From the hallway.
Or they like, I wake every morning, I take a healthy shit, then I take a long piss. You know, every morning at 7 a.m, I take a piss and I take a shit. Well, what's the problem? I don't get up till 9.
You know, that's the best.
So in coming from a family that never really kind of, they wouldn't see that as medical. They would see it as my fault. That, you know, my kidneys were eroding in the 20s and in the 30s. And what was fatigue, I thought, was me working every week in those clubs and being tired was a byproduct of working and traveling. But my kidneys were shutting down. And I remember I was in Las Vegas, and I had come from Toronto, and I was pissing purple. And I didn't go to the doctor, and I didn't say anything. My piss was, I remember I was at a urinal.
Purple. And it wasn't because you were a Prince fan or anything.
No. I mean, I was a Prince fan, but it was, I mean, this shit was like, I'd never seen blood that color.
Right.
And I didn't say anything, man. And I don't know why the fuck I wouldn't say anything. But I'm like, I remember being in the urinal and seeing the purple and seeing a guy next to me, and I moved closer to the urinal so that guy wouldn't see what was coming out of me. Because, you know, sometimes guys look down, and I was like, what the fuck is this? And it was blood. I remember, you know, God rest his soul, Charlie Murphy, who was with us on touring and stuff. And I remember he had a distended stomach, and they had taken like gallons of blood out of him, and he sent me a picture. And it was the color that my blood was. It's purple, like purple.
So it's the same thing. I thought he had cancer.
He had leukemia.
Leukemia, right.
But he was distended, and it was blood. So he'd go in there and get drained and then go back out, and it would bleed again. And I remember saying to Charlie, who I love, and in no way disparage his memory, but he was afraid. You know, I don't think Charlie would have said he was ever afraid, but I know because I was afraid. And I think Charlie was afraid at the beginning. And by the time you're trying to figure out what's going on with you, it gets worse and you're more afraid. Like, I was trying to get him to go to UCLA and get a blood panel. And he said, I went over there and they didn't have me. And I remember telling Linda, who runs my foundation, Charlie didn't show up, did he? And she's like, no, they were waiting for him. You know, they were going to bring him into the back, and he didn't go. Right. And, you know, I can't fault him for anything because I was the same thing. So I thought the only thing you can do is to share your stories and experiences with people that maybe might see something or might have fatigue or might see discoloration or might have a pain in their lower back and question, or have two of those things or all of them and question that it's not fatigue. Because one thing that's so horrible about any disease, but especially about kidney disease, is that it shows up with fatigue. And who's not tired? And you can say, well, you know, I've been working extra hours and the kids, and I don't have a lot of free time and I'm fatigued. But you know, I've seen enough sick kids, man, that I wanted to help somebody. What does that say? Oh, and my eyes got wider. So
is it a symptom of, you know, do you drink, or are you done with that?
You know, I don't drink as much.
Right.
But I don't, hardly any. It's so funny, man, because it's like what people's triggers are, you know, like you don't know what a trigger is. Somebody's like, well, you know, and so I started going to therapy, this guy, and he would say, do you drink at home? And I'm like, no, you don't drink at home. I said, no, I have alcohol all around the house and I never drink at home.
Right.
It's when I'm gone and after the show and the music is the trigger and then the music gets louder and then your friends come in and, you know,
we have the same life. I mean, how do you stop at the end of the night? Because you've accelerated to the point when the show's over and you got dates coming up finally. I know you've been waiting for them and you got a lot coming up. November, but, you're hitting it.
Yeah, but not so much
right.
Alcohol anymore, thank God. And you know, man, I mean, and you try to like lie those nights away or those fucking hangovers away, but I don't give a fuck. I used to think, oh, these people, you know, they don't know that I drink. But it wasn't even about vanity. It was just like, do you really want to fucking torture yourself this much by making your life more difficult by drinking? And at some point you're like, no. You know, Richard Lewis tried to get me to stop completely.
Right.
But I think I'm toward, and I appreciate him for that because he would always reach out to me, you know, and say, you know, how was I doing? Robin too. Robin was like, are you drinking? And I'm like, no. And he goes, you're not? And I said, a little bit. And he's like, oh, you know, call me, man. Like anytime you can talk to me about it. And I thought, wow, man, how fucking,
you know, when you say his name, it just hits you in the heart so much. It will always hit us always. And I just went through that with Norm MacDonald because I was close with Norm and these are, you know, gifts. Robin was a gift. And so are you. I mean,
but no. And I saw that thing. And Norm didn't say anything, did he?
Norm didn't talk about it. Norm kept it for over a decade to himself. And we were going to do something together. And we were working. I was working with him for about 2 years. We were meeting up and I knew something was off. I didn't know what. But then near the end, I kind of figured it out. And then I had a little jump on finding out. But it didn't matter. I would have liked to have hung out with him more. But he had too much pride. Didn't want people to see him that way. And also didn't want to mess up his career in a way that people would think things, you know,
right.
but he was private. He was a private person. But
It's funny you say that he didn't want people to think things because I was sick in the beginning of my show and I didn't tell anybody. And then when I was going to get my transplant or I knew it was in the works, I told Bruce Alford and I told Robert Borden, but I asked them, I told them only out of respect because they would be able to tell that I looked different or that I wasn't as energetic or I was having trouble remembering lines because when your blood's tainted, it affects every part of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to let them know that I was going to go forward and not stop production. And they said, well, how bad is it? And I said, well, it's not ever going to be so bad that we're going to stop production. And he said, why is that? And I said, because if we get off, we're not coming back. And I'm like, fuck it, man. I'll die doing this. Right. I'm not going to stop the show not for the 150 people that worked on the show, but for me. Like I wanted this thing to happen my whole life and it finally happens. And if you're sick during it, I'm like, fuck it, man. I'm all in. I don't give a fuck.
Well, I have the same makeup and that comes from my family and you're growing up and it's a work ethic and you either got it or you don't got it where you're happiest when you're just going, when you're just grinding it.
And it was all the things that I grew up doing. It was stories about growing up. There were even almost reenactments, actual words that my grandmother would say to me, actual things that I would do with my friends, actual things like I got arrested for a DUI in 81 and I was wearing a Bruce Springsteen shirt and with these shorts and I was in Van Nuys and I'm in the fucking drunk tank and they're going to take us in to arraign us. And I'm looking down and there's like these prison slippers and there's painted toenails and I look down and I'm like I look up and there's a big dude in that orange jumpsuit with blonde hair almost like Gorgeous George, you know, and the sheriff comes to the door and he goes Lopez, and I stood up and the dude stood up and the sheriff goes no Mrs. Lopez and I put that in the show word for word Lopez and the guy pulls the bars and he goes no Mrs. Word for word. And I thought, man, you know, when your life is funny like that, word for word, there's no need to write anything. You just lay those things in there.
Yeah.
You know, just lay them in there.
You also lay them in a few times. Like when you have a family member saying something, when you know, you got to eat or something, or your grandmother's saying something, and the microphone all of a sudden is one of her boobs. Yeah. I mean, that's like, I'm in heaven. Because it's so connected, George, because that, you know, it shows your acting. But besides that, it shows your connection. Right. And that's what, you know, that's what the stuff that we love most about our favorite comedians. And you just, was Richard like your first? That was it, because mine too.
Yeah.
Even though.
But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know him, but I didn't know him until toward the end. I met him in the early 90s at the Comedy Store, and he was already in a wheelchair. And then in the early 2000s, I would go over there with Jennifer and
at the house,
and I would sit with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would send them movies. But you know what I did, man? And I was in the car and I heard, they said, comedian Richard Pryor, they said a comedian is diagnosed with MS, and this is like KNX, you know, and then I'm driving and I hear that Richard Pryor has MS. And the first thing I think of is him in the bed. And I go to Best Buy, and these things were brand new. I go and buy satellite radio, and I buy a 2-year subscription, and I find a way to give it to him because I know he's going to be in bed, and I want him to have music, and I want him to have comedy, and I don't really know him, but I just want him to have something that would make that time in the bed less, I don't know, sad.
Yeah.
So that he had satellite radio, and I didn't know him from anybody, man. And that kind of led to Jennifer reaching out to me. But he was, you know, I say he was the only black person my grandmother let in the house. He came by VHS.
Is that accurate?
Oh, my grandmother fucking hated him, man. She would be like, "Are you watching that fucking thing again?" I had that Long Beach special that I watched.
And that's where he shot his first definable special.
At the Long Beach Terrace Theater. And she would come into the living room and she would be like, just shake her head and walk through there. And I couldn't get enough of him, man. I couldn't get enough.
Because it had a truth to it.
You know, it had a truth. And then meeting the character, you know, meeting the people, meeting Mooney.
Mm-hmm.
And...
He always made me laugh, Paul. If he didn't like you, I guess you didn't get the experience we got with Paul. But he liked us.
I wouldn't want to live in the fucking world where Paul Mooney didn't like
me. He didn't like a lot of people.
You know, he was dragging his bag and he had his do-rag and he had an iridescent shirt. And at Burbank Airport, he's walking by me and I'm in the Bronco 2. It's in the early 90s. And I roll the window and I go, "Paul!" He turns around. He's got that big smile. I said, "Let me give you a ride. I'm going to take a test. Let me give you a ride." He comes in, puts his bag in the Bronco 2, and he goes, "Oh, thank you so much, brother." And then he says, "Have you seen Amistad?" And I said, "I haven't seen it yet." He goes, "It's the best black movie ever. All the white people, we go back to Africa, and all the white people die at the end." And I'm like, "Oh, fucking this." I said, "Man." And I just listened. I remember driving and looking over and seeing him just connect things and throw them out at me. And man, I was just so happy it's right here, brother. And, you know, gave me a kiss, gave me a hug, got out. And I thought, what a fucking beautiful experience this was to drive Paul Mooney back to his house from the Burbank airport, man.
How long ago was this?
That was in the early 90s, 93, 94.
Right.
And then he was on my radio show. And the guy, Roy Laughlin, who kind of discovered Rick Dees.
Yeah.
He goes, I said, "Is Paul Mooney here yet?" And then... The girl that was on the radio with me says, "Follow the Shalimar." You know, the and I go in there and he's sitting with his do-rag with his hands on top of each other on his knees. And he goes like this. And I said, "Paul." And I said, "Come on." And he went in there and he was so edgy and so beautiful that the guy, Roy Laughlin, who was married to Ellen Kay, with his fucking chest open and his chair, goes, "That guy's amazing. Bring him back every week." And you wouldn't think that anybody would find him amazing because he said the N-word a few times and he was out there and he was like, no, that fucking guy is radio magic. Like, bring him back.
He was brilliant. I remember in the original room, the first time I saw him, he would promise, I won't say the word, but he would promise all the audience, because it was mostly a white audience, that he would give them a baby under their table. And he would use the N-word. Yeah. And say that's the kind of baby they would get. And because he was mocking how worthless people thought black people were. And so he was quite a pioneer of what we're living right now.
Yeah.
that people aren't getting necessarily the facetiousness or the sarcasm. It's hard right now in that.
Well, you know, they used to say fuck them if they can't take a joke.
Yeah.
Which was the really kind of the our credo. And now it's like, fuck us. We don't like your joke. So,
yeah.
So we gave the weapon to, we gave the power to the audience and they took it away from the comedian.
But we're not, you know, we're still not going to. I just have to figure out, I'm out there touring. I want to do a new special. My new stuff is different. I'm 65. I figured some shit out.
Yep.
Your last special, I'm not kidding you. We'll Do It for Half on Netflix. I watched it twice and it's really fucking great.
Thank you.
It's, you must have been so happy with it.
Well, you know, I did a little bit different. Yeah, I did a little bit different. You know, I did more family stuff. I did more stuff with the uncle.
Yep.
You know, and the Llorona, the lady, the crying lady who kills her kids. And, you know, like, hey, who would win between Annabelle and the Llorona? The uncle's like, hey, fucking, that bullshit. Fucking, if she killed her own kids, you don't think she'd fuck a little doll up? And you're like, yeah, okay, you're right.
What's so funny is you hear the family talking. That's what's... That's
and that was the whole Richard Pryor thing. Like, you know, I would go like, okay, where does he, how does he go from there to there so seamless? And there's no permission. You just can slide in from one place to the other and to one and into another place and the other. So, you know, the segues for comedians when they start were always the most difficult thing. I remember being in rooms where the comedian would, his segue was so bad that the audience would laugh.
Right.
Because they're like, oh shit, they're like, where did that come from?
Right.
You know, and it's the transitions were so bad that you had to laugh because it's like, you know, that's part of like, you know, the seamlessness of being a stand-up is nobody's supposed to see that. You wouldn't go buy a shirt where they go, is your fucking, is this a, they put a seam across this? You go, yeah, they did, man. That's what they fucking hide that stuff. And that was the thing when somebody was really good that they could just be like skiing. You know, the guy would go down and he'd make a bigger loop and then he'd come down and then he'd be tight. And it was just so beautiful to see a guy, you know, not knowing where he's going, but not lost at any time, you know.
It's the whole thing is surfing. The whole, and music's that way also, which you're also great at. I mean, there's a lot of things you love.
Thank you. Yeah. And you know, you kind of find yourself along the way and it takes years. Like it's not, 1 year is not going to do it. You're not going to find yourself in 2 years and 5 years. And you find yourself going down that road. And the minute that you lose a lot of the things that a lot of young standups do, because that's what young standups do, you kind of separate yourself from the, it's almost like when you watch a commercial about depression, are you depressed? And then the body cracks and the depressed guy goes away. And then a person of, you know, colorful guy comes out. It goes because he found either his medicine, but we found our voice or our niche or whatever. When somebody would come and see me and they go, I'm not Mexican, so I don't know. And then the minute the show started, they were like, oh, you don't have to be Mexican to understand that. Or somebody would say, I'm Croatian and my mom did the same thing, you know, or I'm from, you know, I'm Russian and that's, it's economic. It's not Mexican. It's about economics.
But you brought that into all of your, you've done six specials and you brought it from the very moment I saw you doing stand-up. You did it. You had inclusion all the time. And you're going, this is my background, but it could be any of our backgrounds. Right. And family is family. And you always found a way, especially in, I mean, you did live HBO stuff and that is the shit.
Yeah. Thank you.
And how did Well, Chris, what was that? What's that like for you? You know, like The Wall, for example.
I think from boxing, and you know, Richard loved boxing. You know, you love boxing. People mm-hmm. love boxing, and there's no. You can train for a year, go out there, and in 14 seconds be on your back.
Yeah,
you know, this guy's like, I got caught. You know, I was fucking. Or guys would when I met Oscar De La Hoya, he would say that. You know, I said, what about when guys say I didn't have it tonight? And he goes, no, man. I mean, sometimes you just don't have it and you try to find it. But he goes, sometimes in the morning, I would wake up and I would be like, I don't have it. And I would have to find it during the day. And right. I like the fact that you had to be ready that day. And then I did the Why You Crying special for Showtime. And then Ken, what was that guy's name? The producer. Oh, fuck.
Cragen?
No, this other guy, I can't remember. He's the one that edited pretty much, and I didn't like what he did. I mean, it's a good special. People like it, but I didn't like that my material was in someone else's possession.
Right.
So I thought, well, how do I prevent that? And then we started to do them live, and when I told HBO I wanted to do it live, they were all over that. They were like, yeah, you know, let's do it. Because then to me, like boxing, you had to be ready that night.
Yeah.
For something you knew that was a year away. And it's like, you know, you're going to train. Yes. You're going to do your road work. Yes. You're going to do your club work. You're going to get out of town and go on a bus and find it out there in the middle of the night. Yes. And it became the process.
And I actually, we did the same thing. I watched you on a View recently, fairly recently, promoting your Netflix special. And you were saying, they say you get in, and Whoopi knows this better than anybody, that you get into training. And mm-hmm. that's what I'm in training right now. I might not look at
it. Don't know.
But I am, because I can't wait to do it. But doing live, that's like you're a gladiator, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, we're like, you know, doing the podcast and stuff like that, that, you know, you're not going to get canceled here and you can speak freely, you know. And like, I have Gil Carrillo sitting across from me, and he's the detective that, along with the guy Frank Salerno, did that whole Netflix documentary. You know, they caught the Night Stalker, and, you know, we're fans of true crime. I find behavior interesting. I find the quirks and the things that are wrong with these guys, or the fact that they, like, Ted Bundy was a good looking dude. People trusted him. Rodney Acala had a camera, and he'd go out there and take pictures of girls. And those guys are like, they're like fucking spiders to get a fly, you know?
Yeah.
They lay there and nobody knows they're there. And then so when Ina, my publicist, said, "Have you seen the Night Stalker documentary?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to watch it." And then I saw it like three times in the same day. And I said, "Oh, this guy, I got to get this guy on." And once he came on, I found like a kindred spirit in this dude, 71, detective, East LA. And I found a guy that was like an opposite to me. Like he was a detective, and he was out there trying to find Richard Ramirez. And then I'm just asking him, "So what about that guy that hit him, that took the fucking pole out of the fence and fucking hit him over the head?" And Richard Ramirez was climbing in that car. It's got that fucking bandaid on his head. And they're like, the cop didn't know he'd been a sheriff for a week, and is like, "What's your name?" And then he's got this bandage and he's bleeding. "It's me, man. It's me. I'm him. You know, fucking get me out of here." And I mean, that shit is not funnier than anything funnier than real life. And he came on the podcast, and immediately it just became a different podcast, and it became
Now that's what I want to ask you, because when it first started, it was like, "Oh my god, hi!" Yeah. And you do obviously hilarious Valley Girl, funny oh my god, yeah, white people in the Valley voices. but that's what I started listening, and then it turned into this whole different rabbit hole that I started to go down. And I don't have time for that many podcasts, but yeah, I've been listening.
Thank you.
It's fucking fascinating, because murderers kind of turn me the other way. Right. I can't take it. But this is you. You're so interested in it. It's the whole ball of wax. And it's really good.
You know, I wasn't much of a reader, dyslexic. You know, I remember when my daughter, Maya, they found out, Ann told me, you know, Maya's dyslexic. And I was driving on the freeway and I started crying. And she's like, "What's the matter?" And I said, no, nothing. And she goes, "Are you crying?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Why?" And I said, because I'm dyslexic, and nobody ever gave a fuck about me enough to test me. And I was already in my 40s. And I thought, you know, she's going to get help for her dyslexia, but she probably got it from me. And then nobody ever thought I was important enough to test.
But maybe.
You know, fuck it. And then she goes, "Well, you can get tested now." And I'm like, "I'm not going to get tested now, because I don't want to change the process of how I think. I don't want anybody going back there fucking rewiring me. I kind of like the fact that I can't read a page, and I'm a better auditory processor," which we all are. Like, I remember when I would go to acting class and she would read it, was so bad. And she goes, "Read it to me." And I'm like, no. "You read it the way that you want me to say it. And then I'll hear it. And then I'll go and do it." And she's like, "No, that's not the way acting works. I'm going to read it, and then you're going to read it to me." And I couldn't even read to the acting coach. And this was like 3 months before we filmed the pilot of the show. And I thought, okay, well, I'm in the right place and I got the right lady. And gradually she pulled me out of that even before we started to do the show. But it, you know, I knew enough to know that I couldn't act naturally and that it wasn't something that was just there for me, that I had to do some work. But I knew that if I didn't do it, I didn't think that show would last if I didn't
right.
have an acting coach.
Do you think that dyslexia connected you more to the words for you of what you were saying, the meaning of it? Because I can't connect to words if they're not well written. And sometimes they just don't go in.
It made me concise. You know, it made me not waste a lot of words. It made me be, concise, where if you thought about therapy or group therapy, and if you're in there with your family and they say, well, you know, my father always minimized me and he never really made me feel important. I could just hear my family go, well, that's your fucking fault. Why are you going to blame him? So, you know,
there's right? truth to that.
Why are you bitching about him? But that's you. You'll be
right.
You know?
Right.
And I mean, that to me, those are the things that you hear at a different angle that makes stand-up as beautiful as it is, you know. Like, I remember I went to do, I did a thing with Jeff Foxworthy, and Jeff Foxworthy saw me, and just like a comedian, he goes, ah, fuck, now I gotta be good. I didn't know you were here. But now that you're here, I gotta fucking be good. He goes, now I gotta redo my set. He goes, I could go up there and bullshit. But now that I see you and you're gonna be in the room. So I thought of something in the back of the room at Eastlake Golf Course, Billy Andrade's golf tournament. And Sam Jackson, a lot of guys, Ahmad, all the guys are there. And I thought, I'm going to do this. So I walk up and they introduce me, and I walk up and I said, it's great to be here in such a great room full of racists. And it's silent. And then I go, hang on a second. And I take my glasses out of my pocket and I said, hang on, I put them on and I take my paper out and I go, fundraisers. The fuck was I? Fundraisers. And they fucking laughed for 10 minutes. I really didn't have to do anything else. Full of racist, silence, fundraisers. And they laughed for like 5 minutes and I think I left. I said, that's it. Just fucking, I only need one.
It's how long you can take the quiet for that proves who you are.
That's
another thing that you do in your stand-up. And I just at 65 started figuring it out like 3 years ago that I'm loving just letting the moment sink. And that is what's so funny. Besides that, you're talking about real poignant shit. You're talking about what's wrong with the world. You know, with the wall, you go right in, but then there's all this family stuff. So, and you did the same thing, like, in We'll Do It for Half. It's
very
pointed. Well,
you had the Secret Service come to my house, Bob. I had the fucking Secret Service come to my house.
And why is that?
Two agents. So 2 years ago, you know, Cedric the Entertainer.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's like the old joke. My agent came to my house?
Yeah. So, somebody said they were my friend. So I go to the chateau. I take Cedric's daughter and his wife, Lorna, and the kids to lunch. And then I'm not looking at my phone. You can't look at your phone there. And I get out and I get in the car and it says, Iran offers a $80 million bounty for Donald Trump, alleged, I have to say. And in the car, I type on my phone, we'll do it for half. And when I get home, it says Ina, and whenever I go hello, and she goes, are you alone? That's when I know I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Because she's like, are you alone? And I said, yes. She goes, what did you say? Where have you been? What did you write? I said, about what? Did you write something about the president? And I, what do you mean? Like, did you say something? I said, yeah, I wrote on Hollywood Unlocked. I said, we'll do it for, oh, fuck, George Bannon. You're this thing's going to fucking blow up. Like, they're considering a threat against the president of the United States. I said, she goes, this is bad. This is going to be bad. And then in 2 hours, it's everywhere. And then the Fox News says that I'm going to get arrested. And then by Wednesday, they say that thousands of people have called the FBI. They want me to be arrested. You know,
right? I'm not clear, though. What exactly did you do wrong? You were offering a discount.
Offering a discount is a threat. That's good, but this could be. And then they came to my house, and I read that. I saw that they said, "Well, on the news, they go, well, comedian George Lopez can be expecting a visit from the United States Secret Service." And I said, "They're not going to come for that." And then she goes, "Hey, get your attorney ready, because next Wednesday at 10 o'clock in the morning, they're going to come to your house." And they came to my house, and they had everything I'd ever put on Instagram or Twitter, everything, Bob. And they came to assess whether I was a threat to him. And it was a trip, man.
It doesn't make any sense.
To be a lifer and to get in the, what would I call it? I don't know. That is one of the biggest stories in the news, that they're calling for my fucking confinement. They want me to be arrested. They want me to be charged with a felony, threatening the life of a United States president.
But you pale in comparison to all of the people during his administration.
Mm-hmm. So the greatest part was that they took out a, you know, it's like in the movies, they open the briefcase, and they put a paper in the, and my attorney looks at it, and he goes, "We're not signing this." And he puts it back on the table, and I go, "What is that?" And the other agent says, "Well, this gives us permission to look through your medical records and all of your health records. You authorize us." And I go, "I'm not signing that." And they get it, like almost in the movie. I go, "Does anybody sign that?" And they put it in the briefcase, and they close it and snap both of the latches closed. They go, "Sometimes." I said, "Who the fuck would sign that?" And they, I said, "You want some coffee? Want some water?" Nothing. And I don't think I was ever going to get arrested, but it was concerning to think that free speech could get a guy visited by the Secret Service. Like, there's not enough other things to.
But you look at what's going on now with the cancellation. And, you know, "We'll Do It For Your Half" was just before it started getting really out of hand.
Yeah. And, you know, those things, you know, like, you know, nobody knows this, but in amongst the Alec Baldwin tragedy, right, the horrific tragedy that is, mm-hmm, I was looking through who the AD was. And in some of his credits, I found a movie that I was in, and I haven't told this to anybody, but we did a scene with Christopher Walken, and I had an Uzi, and I'm not a gun guy. I don't like guns. You know, I think in a past life, you know, I had somebody say that, you know, I'm uncomfortable around them. And even when I was on the radio, they were short police officers, and they said, "You know, George, if you want to do this campaign on the radio, we'll take you to over there in Granada Hills. They have one of those wet tracks where the cars, they teach you how to spin out and all this stuff. And they have like the street where the guy comes over and you decide whether you're going to shoot. It could be a robber, or it could be a lady with a little kid. You know, they teach you kind of spontaneous reactions and stuff." And they had helmets on and paint guns, like shooting. And I told those guys, "Hey," I said, "I can't do this, man." And they go, "What do you mean?" I said, I don't want to shoot anybody, and I don't want to get shot at." So they did it without me. And I was the only person out of like 25 people not to do it. So when I'm looking at this guy's name, I don't remember the name, but I remember the movie. And we did a scene where myself and the other two actors were running out of a room after shooting at some people. Now they're going to shoot at us. And there were these ceramic vases, like five of them. And as we ran by, the squibs were going to explode the vases, that we were being like trailed by gunfire. So right before lunch, we did it. And then as we ran, the sound of the gunfire was real, but the vases collapsed like this. They just went, you know, five of them in a row, they just kind of folded. Right. And then they yelled cut, and they said, no, these things have to explode. They have to blow up. So they had lunch, and then they redid it after lunch. But I know, because I saw those guys with the vases, I said, these motherfuckers are putting fucking dynamite in these things, like, you know, because they have to explode. So fucking dangerous, man.
Yeah, so, I mean, your eyes can be destroyed.
We're running, And now they start to explode, but they're fucking like a 4th of July firecracker. Boom, boom, boom. And then we're down like, what the fuck? I look up and one of the actors leans back like this because he catches it in his back. And then the female actress turns this way. And then I'm running like this. And I look at them and I'm like, holy shit. And when we get through the door, both doors close and they yell cut. And they're looking straight ahead. And they're just like contorted like this. And they turn around and their eyes go like this. And they go, you're bleeding. And I go, I am. And they go, your face, you're bleeding. And I said, I am. And I go like this. And fucking my whole arm is full of blood. And the ceramic that was flying went into my face maybe 20 times with these little, like almost like slivers of that ceramic porcelain or ceramic in the plaster of Paris, whatever, in this side of my face. And they're fucking speechless. They're like, and I go like that in my whole hand and I'm fucking bleeding. And we're not going to do it again. We got it. But Bob, if I had been looking that way,
you would have lost your
eyes. I would have lost my fucking eyes.
Yeah, that's.
I went this way, but.
Are you saying it's the same second AD?
It's the same. Allegedly, it may be the same AD, and that's just my experience. I wasn't there in New Mexico. I'm just saying that sometimes when something doesn't work the first time, the thing to do is to go back there and go, oh yeah, I could just see the guy put in the fuck. We'll make this because the first time they just collapsed. There was nothing they could use. So they go, they got to explode. And they exploded at the safety of the actors running by.
That's a horrific thing. And it's the ammunitions people that have to know the amount and stuff. So this was under pressure to do something for a director, I assume.
Well, they didn't have the shot. It didn't work the way that they wanted those things to explode. So they had to get them to, you know, to make it look like they were being shot.
And with the common tragedy right now, everybody's going, why don't they just CGI? Because that's the new world. But unfortunately, if you're doing a movie, and I know that this one that Alec was on was lower budget, I understand. So if you've got a $1 to $4 million budget, CGI is not always that easy. No. But they can't continue this anymore because life is too, it's insane. There is no argument.
Yeah, I've done a lot of movies in New Mexico. And, you know, I've done a few movies. And the common thing in movies, as the common thing in TV, I think, would be to make your day. And a lot of times if you're going to try to make the day. And I think the first thing that gets a little risky is the stuff that involves actors, you know, the safety of actors, I think.
Well, that's going to change. I mean, a lot's changing. The world's changing, but we're talking about human life now.
And I think in Narcos, you know, those guys, they all CGI and fire and all that stuff. But
Squid Game is not CGI. They actually killed those people. Have you watched that?
Squid, man, I can't. It's too much. I think it's too much for me.
Isn't that interesting? Because I did watch it, but I have found that everything's too much. At the point now, we are numb, and you go and interview people all the time. Not interview, have conversations with on your podcast. But I find murder and death in movies to be pure pornography now.
Hey, have you seen Squid Games, Gil, on Netflix? I'd be interested to see what you think.
I thought it was going to be about squid. I didn't know. I thought it was going to be about sushi.
Where does squid come from? Why do they say you call them squids?
You know, I guess it's because it's a video game of sorts. I don't remember. I think they showed a squid in it once in the beginning.
I think it may be the most violent. It may be the most violent of
those. Well, it's basically a Holocaust. It's a game show Holocaust, and it's supposed to be like Hunger Games, right? But you ain't hungry after it.
No.
It's just, and I remember this year, the 20th anniversary, 9/11, and I'm watching, doesn't matter what news network you turn on. They used to, until this year, put up something saying that these images are too graphic. And so that a 10-year-old walking by the damn TV at 4 in the afternoon wouldn't be seeing it, but they still showed people jumping out of the buildings. And they should not be showing that.
Right.
First thing, almost at all. But if you're going to show it, it's so that it doesn't happen again, and it hits you, and it and you, we try to save this world from the insanity it's under. And there should have at least been, please, these are images, and they don't even care now. They just run it.
Well, the idea, you know, the idea that as this country, you know, I had my foundation dinner in Brentwood. You drive by the VA hospital, and there's people, there's veterans living on the street there.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't happen. You know, they were deporting Latinos back to Mexico or back to South America who were illegal, but who were undocumented, but they served in the war, in the Vietnam and in, you know, the Afghanistan, and they were deporting veterans.
Oh yeah.
And I thought that, and especially in 9/11, that, you know, when John Stewart went to Congress and in the Senate, and the guy had cancer, and you could see that the lady that was covered in dust passed away from cancer. But as a country, if we don't, you know, take care of the people that protect us and those people who were innocent, who lost their lives, and the families for generations and generations to come, that if there's one thing that we can do as a country is to take care of the people who suffer in this country, you know, and not look at them as, well, we're going to find the money. Fuck it. Find the money somewhere. You know, the lottery was supposed to change the school system. It got fucking worse. Growing up, I went to LAUSD here, and it was great back then. Mm-hmm. And it's fucking awful now. I've had to buy schools basketballs. I've had to buy schools paper and pens and pencils because of the red tape you have to go through to get it from the school district, that I just said, fuck it. I'm just going to go to Office Max, or I'll give you a couple $100 and you just go buy it yourself, which is, they're not supposed to do, but they'll do it because that's what a teacher has to do. And a teacher who makes no money, but still decides to be a teacher, should be looked after as well as nurses and all those people that take care of people.
Of course. It's such a hypocrisy. It's actually, George Carlin did this poignant piece. He would probably be canceled today for some of the things, but I know you know the piece, which is where he said, you know, he talked about something that's not a very popular topic. He talked about people that terminate a life before someone's born. And he said, before you're born, they care about you. And then after you're born, fuck you. And then you go, then you're okay through school. And then you go and, oh, you want to enlist? Oh, we love you again. Okay, so now you're enlisted. Now you come back from serving your time, back from Iraq. Fuck you. They don't take care of the veterans. And it's our job, because it's not being done by the government. It's our military, our people. I mean, there are so many. I'm going to take a really quick break, because I know we both have lives, but I'm just going to sell something that either helps mental health or shaves your balls.
That's what we do. Yeah, we got that.
Yeah, do the same. Okay, we're back. This is why I love podcasts, because we're back. So I want to ask you, have you been down to the border? We've been going through this for years now. I mean, decades.
I've seen the border at Del Rio where the Haitians were trying to come through. Mm-hmm. I've been out there. I've seen the wall, the slats in it. There was a golf course there along the border that closed, and it said on a couple of signs while you're playing, please do not hit your golf balls into Mexico. Can't get them back. But the tunnels, airplanes, you want to build a fucking wall, there's airplanes. And just the simplicity of somebody's response to think that they could fix immigration by building a wall and using all of that money to do the wall is ridiculous to me. That was, you know, the wall, you know, Troy Miller, man, you know, Troy Miller.
I love Troy. Did he direct that and the new one?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. Troy Miller says, you got to call it the wall. We're going to do it in D.C. at the Kennedy Center. Mm-hmm. I did Eddie Murphy's Mark Twain Award. You were there.
Yeah.
And when I went up there and did my stand up, I did a little bit of stand up, and I liked the reaction. And I said, oh, shit, I think this might be the place to do the next HBO special. HBO liked it. And then the Kennedy Center said, hey, we're all about free speech, so don't worry about us. We got you. And then
I wasn't there, by the way. I just
I thought you were there.
No, it must have been someone that maybe David Copperfield just looked like me. I thought about it for a second. I thought I was there, but I wasn't.
I thought you were there.
No, I should have been. I wanted to be.
So and doing it there and then doing it live, and then
and you did it live at the Kennedy Center, and it's so meaningful. You were what a so special Troy, thing.
So in the about 2 months before, Troy says, you know, we have a call, and he goes, This is what I'm seeing for the set. Like you see the sign of says, you know, the people crossing, and he goes, in the back, I'm gonna build a wall like with the metal. It's gonna look like a wall, and there's gonna be an American flag, and the flag is gonna be upside down because we're in distress. Mm-hmm. And when he's done talking, I said, fucking great. And then, you know, the agents and the managers are like, hey, man, I don't think you should have the flag upside down. What do you think, George? And I go, yeah. Troy, listen, man, don't put the flag upside down, dude. Okay. And we get there to rehearse, the fucking flag is upside down. And I said, I thought they told you not to put the flag upside down. And he goes, fuck them. He goes, I see it upside down. And it's going to be upside down. And even though you said you didn't want it upside down, I knew you wanted it upside down. And I was never going to change it. And now it's too late to change it. And it looks fucking great. And then I said, what about at the end of the special if I go under the wall? What if I go under? And then the fucking second AD goes, you sure you're going to fit? And I said, motherfucker, I'll fit. That time Richard Pryor walked off stage at the Aladdin when he looked at everybody laughing at him, and he thought, what the fuck am I doing here? Who am I doing this for? And he left out the wrong side of the stage, and there was just a little like a bathroom window, mm-hmm. and he would have to walk through. You know, sometimes the stage is like, there's nothing over here and everything's over there.
Right.
And he saw that little ass window, and he thought, because he told everybody to kiss his ass, fuck you motherfuckers. And he walks off the wrong side, and he sees a little window, and he thinks, I got to get through that fucking window because I'm not walking back across the stage. People will laugh at me. So Jennifer even said, I don't know how he got through that fucking window. It was tiny. And he made himself get through that window, and he was gone. I think that's when he went to Berkeley for 2 years.
Did you ever see that piece of material he did after the fire? He got on stage after he'd caught himself on fire. And he talked about it, and I saw him work it out in the main room. You must have seen him at that point, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you weren't close with him, but you saw him then. He did that thing that he said, if there was a fire in here and you were all crowded around the exit, I would eat through people's asses to get out of this room. He said, you'd be standing there, and then he acts it out, being Richard. And then you go, I'd be going, you know, he mouthed that he's gnawing through.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Genius. Man. So, I mean, wow. So,
you know, those things, even like one time when we would go to the Comedy Store and just hang out, me and my buddy Ernie, you know, so there's this canary yellow Rolls Royce outside of the sidewalk,
right?
And it's idling, and it's a Rolls Royce, so it's just really low. And I and Ernie goes, man, that's fucking Richard Pryor. I go, what? I look over there, and he's going, go say hello. And I'm like, yeah, fucking 20 minutes to walk like 5 feet. And when I get to the window, I look inside, and he's got his microcassette recorder, and he's rewinding it, and you can hear the laughter. And I back up like this, and he goes, you say hello? And I go, no, I don't need to. He goes, why not? I said, man, I fucking seen everything I need to see.
Yeah.
If Richard Pryor's still fucking taping his act and he's in between shows, he's fucking rewinding it in his car. If I knocked on the door, I could never live with myself. I saw what I was meant to see.
Yeah.
A guy that Richard Pryor working on his material. I said, I'm fine.
Before he went on stage, just notes, pages of notes, and then recording. I never heard the recording story. I never didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, shit.
So, George, you have this way, you have this amazing way of being able to say things that might not sit well with people politically. And yet there's something about who you are, because you got so much love in your heart, George, that you're able to get it doesn't have to end on a joke at all. I mean, it doesn't always. It ends on a, you know, mm-hmm. nothing left to say. You put the mic down, you know, drop it or whatever.
Right.
But what can we do that so more people can be like you?
You know, I think if somebody, Bob, I mean, I think, you know, you've done your years, you know, I think if somebody has to think about how they're going to convey a message, then they're already losing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think about saying, I better not say this. I said, hey, they better build that fucking wall in a day because they're going to go out there. That fucking material is going to be gone. They did steal the material, by the way, but that was over there. And then he said, we were rapists and criminals. And if I see them, I'm going to rob them and I'm going to fuck them. That I never said, you know, it was always that. And right now what's in there is, oh shit, I can't think, but it's.
Well, there's so many rumors of what's going on over there. And I'm just seeing footage from 3 years ago, the same footage of people walking in lines. And it's just the same stock footage at this,
you know,
point.
Bobby, you know, at Major League Baseball games, there's people throwing fucking blows and damaging. They're fighting. They're drinking too much and they're fighting. And they're fighting in front of families. They're fighting in front of kids. And they're fighting with each other. And they're shit-faced. And they're ganging up on people. And they're kicking their ass. And a friend of mine trains Urias. And he trains Mexican players in baseball in Mexico. And he sends me videos. And they're dancing. And they're cheering. And there's music. And there's bands. And nobody's fighting. They're celebrating. And nobody's right. fighting. So the image that we see or that they want us to see of other countries is not the way it is in those countries, I believe.
I agree with you. I think we are being shoveled loads of hate, and we're seeing it on networks that we think are more liberal that wouldn't do that, but it's all selling. They're selling yeah. messaging. And then they come out with something new the next day and nothing sticks. They're just getting you addicted. It's really.
Remember when we went to Rodney Dangerfield's funeral?
Yeah.
And they put him, Louis was standing by the, we're all standing by the graveside. We know Roseanne and everybody, you were there, Lou, everybody was there.
Yeah.
And they put him down and then it's still. And then Louis goes, are we supposed to do anything like put dirt in there? And everybody started laughing because he was just like, it was so silent. And he's like, are we supposed to do anything? And man, it was so sweet. And we all laughed and yeah, man.
We were also told I officiated that thing and that was like 3 hours long. And we all loved him because he was Rodney, you know, he was that, he meant it. I mean, no respect. He meant it. And we'd all been there. All of us had no respect for different reasons. And there was a prayer in Jewish that I was going to say, but I was told not to. That's not what the request of his widow wanted, which I thought was unfortunate because he wasn't religious, but he was born Jacob Cohen. So you throw a little bit of everything in. You just give it a little bit of everything. You know, you thank Jesus, you thank. And Ronnie didn't believe in any, you know, once you're gone, man. You know, he was.
But he was special, man. It's nobody.
He was. Did you ever hang out with him where you.
I saw, we were in Bally's and he was in there smoking weed with his balls hanging out his robe.
Oh, that's how.
We were sitting there. Hey, you want something?
That's it.
You know, and we were like. Fuck, man. I just, I couldn't get enough of him, man.
Yeah, me too. When I got too close with him, which meant I would have to spend some time away from him a little bit because it was, I didn't like to smoke pot that much. And also I didn't want to look at his balls that much.
But he'd go to the Laugh Factory like that and his balls would come out two or three times during the set.
Yeah, he wore safari pants. He would wear like, and his shirt was open down so you'd see the scar.
Man.
He was.
And you know what? Nobody like that either. Like these guys are one of ones and they go and they're gone. There's no other Rodney coming out.
It's once every 100 years, something like that comes along.
Yeah.
And then Robin is a whole different.
You know, I went to dinner in February of that year. When Robin in August and we were sitting at the table with Cheadle and Anthony and the waiter goes, Robin's over there. And we look and he looked kind of somber, you know, it was Zelda and her boyfriend. And he walked by us and he goes, you know, Robin, right? I go, yeah. Where is he? He goes, it's right there. So I walk over and I go, Robin, and I touch him and he turns around, he grabs my face like this. And he goes, hey, I didn't see you. And I said, you all right? And I said, yeah, man. How are you, man? Good. He has me by the face like this. Mm-hmm. And I said, How's the shit? He had that crazy ones on CBS, and he was talking about it being single camera. And he's like, you know, I can't do it because they laugh and it's a blown take. So I he was having a bit of a tough time over there.
He was. And they should have renewed it just because it's Robin. But that's when he was starting to, his mind was going. Yeah. But then I flash back and I watch you come out, and I come out as Tony Montana.
Ooh.
At the, and this is another one of those moments where you said a lot, but you didn't have to, but you and Al Pacino, you're doing a tribute to him for the AFI. And anybody that hasn't seen this needs to do an easy, deep Google dive to see you fucking destroy being purely hilarious. It was, what went through, I have to know what went through your mind, because you had Al's right there. You got Robin crying. I mean, I just, it made me think of it. He's
Oliver
crying.
Oliver Stone, Sean Connery.
Sean Connery smiling his ass off. How often do you see that?
I got the call and they said, Al Pacino wants you to do Scarface at his AFI thing. And then it's just silent on the phone. And they go, are you there? And I said, I'm here. And they go, I said, what do you want me to tell him? I said, you got to tell him no. And she goes, you want me to tell him no? And I said, call me back in half an hour. And I'm upstairs, I'm walking around in a fucking circle. And I go, I don't, he calls back. What do you think? I said, no, it's no. You want me to tell him, call me back in another half hour. So I'm walking around and I think, I don't really do characters. I said, but the only way to do it is to do it as Tony Montana.
Yeah.
So I call the work, Michelle, and I go, can you find me a suit like a Tony Montana, like Scarface with that thing? I do my hair down and
get a chain.
And I said, she goes, yeah, with the boots and all that shit. And I said, okay. Calls me back. You're not going to tell Al Pacino no. You don't want me to tell. I said, I don't want to tell him no. I said, but the only way I can do it is if I do it as Tony Montana. And so they're happy. And now I'm like, what am I going to do? So I get this guy, John Max, who writes a lot of the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, just, you know, guide me through this thing. And then we started to do the whole thing. Tony Montana said, you know, he said, first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get a woman. You know who said that first? Rosie O'Donnell. You know, fucking.
It was ridiculous. It brought the house down.
I said, what if you put Scarface in the, frankly, Scarlet, I don't give a fuck. And then I said, Jerry Maguire, you had me at fuck you. And we're not in fucking Kansas anymore, Toro. And I go, look at Hugh Hefner. He has a look in his eye like he hasn't been fucked in an hour. And it's all of that shit. And then I get the idea the day of, I go in the kitchen and I get some baking soda and I put it in a baggie. Mm-hmm. And Ann, fucking Ann is like, I love, you know, I appreciate Ann. But she said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to put this in my pocket. And at the end, I'm going to put my face in it. You're not, that's fucking cheap. You're not going to do that. And I said, why then fucking, why ask me?
Right.
I'm going to do it. So I said, okay. I pull that thing out, open the bag, all of this. It's all over. I said, roll the clip. You know, fucking all.
You actually did it with more dignity at the end. You were like, you did it as a tribute. You almost broke character with a face covered in fake Coke.
Roll the clip. Fucking the best ending ever. And it is probably, you know, I've done a lot of great things. It may be the thing I'm the most proudest of, because it was the thing that scared me the most. And I said, well, I can't break character. From the time I put this clothes on, I can't break character. I get out there and I see Sam Jackson. He goes, hey, motherfucker, what you doing? And I'm like, I'm dread at Scarface, man. And I'm trying not to, because I don't want to say, oh, I'm doing this thing. I had to stay in the thing. And then he was, and even he said, motherfucker, that's the craziest shit I've ever seen.
That was pure commitment. But you also did something else because of who you are, George. You had physically, it wasn't Al Pacino. So you're doing kind of wild and crazy guys kind of movement.
Yeah. You're just moving. And yeah, your, arms, all that shit. Your arms are going back and forth.
It's staggering. You're like, I lived. You know, it's up there. I lived. So, but that, you know, I mean, listen, man. I mean, I started the Comedy Store in Westwood. It's a fucking Italian restaurant now. And they had the little arcade thing right across that little alley. And we'd go in there and play.
What year was that? Because I'm sure I was hosting that.
It was June of 79.
Yeah, I got there in 78. That's where she put me, Mitzi. After a little bit of OR stuff.
There was some great guys there. And it was just such an innocent place that, I mean, Shanling, you know, Howie Mandel, you, Thomerson, John Fox, Joy Gaynor, Robert Aguayo, Danny.
Was Kennison there yet? Or was that like 1981 or something?
Yeah. And I mean, and then that little arcade across the way, and that guy would be playing pinball, and they go, "You're up next." And then the other guy would come in, and he'd play for the guy, you know. And to go from there to everything that's happened, I wouldn't have imagined any of it. I wouldn't have dreamt that big.
When you watch yourself at the very beginning, some of those really early TV appearances, I mean, you just had it. I mean, you were wearing suits when you started, you know? I mean, who goes and plans that? You know, a few people these days, John Mulaney starts when he starts doing stand-up, puts on a suit, and you go, wow, that's a dressed-up dude.
Yeah.
You know, you brought a dignity to something. You got to help me with something. I need a little help. I have, you know, I don't speak Spanish. I am sad about it. Chingon has many meanings.
Chingon, yeah.
Chingon. I say it wrong. I can't even do the, I can't roll my R's.
Chingon is like.
My lack of Spanish is much worse than your dyslexia. That's what I'm telling you.
Oh, I think it is. I'm going to say yes. Chingon is like badass. It could be motherfucker. It could be great. It depends on.
Fucking awesome. You
know, fucking awesome. It could be, hey, that's chingon. That's nice. It could be, es chingon. That, you know, like now it's almost like being the king of pop. Like, you know, like having a title, because I go to the airport and you go into the bar and you get a drink and that guy says, yeah, you got chingon. You know, like it follows me around. And I would have never thought that, you know, somebody's, you know, when you're kids, you're like, I want a nip game, you know, that everybody call me like, you know, call me Rock, you know, nobody calls you Rock. But then everywhere you go, if I go to a hotel or I go somewhere and they see me and they're like, hey, chingon, you know, like almost like out of respect.
It's like my brother, my man, my friend, the person that they relate to. And that's what I think that I treasure about my career. And I know you feel it because you have for a long time, you were one of the only representatives of the entire Latino community as a stand-up. And so did you know from the very beginning that you would have this in a positive, righteous way to represent this entire world of people that was not really, I mean, Freddie Prinze represented, but it was still doing the same kind of jokes about, because we joke about the people that we're from, otherwise we get in trouble or canceled.
No, I, you know what? I didn't, man. I wasn't the most outgoing guy. So I learned everything and it just kind of, you know, these things chip away. And then I remember there was a guy, I think his name was Billy Brown. He was a little dude and he would do like impressions. And he was a little kind of a squirmy little guy. And one night he was talking about Mexicans and he goes, you ever see the way they walk? It's like they got like wheels under their feet. Like, it's like they don't have feet. They have wheels. Like they just kind of roll around. And then I was like two guys ahead and I said, hey, you know, Billy Brown said that we don't have feet. And I think he knows different now because I fucking put this one up his ass. and it was like an ad lib that I thought I would do. You know, I hadn't written it down. And they fucking went crazy.
Yeah, because it's the truth.
Shit. I said, all right, you know, this is the thing. And it just slowly you start to look at people and you start to, you know, fuck with people and start to look at things and, you know, say things that aren't right, but not lament. You know, I don't really spend too much time on any particular subject, you know.
No, so. You make your statement and there's still a lot of love and now more than ever. I mean, I'm sure you're wondering, what am I going to do to outdo that last special? Because we're watching history unfold right now. What justice is going on?
Yeah.
Where is justice?
But, you know, like I was watching this thing called The Bleeding Edge on Netflix, and it's about the medical world and how these devices are made, but they're not. The FDA passes them, but they're not safe. And you see these people that, you know, a woman that got remarried and she went and got like a tubal ligation thing. It's like a little coil and it made her bleed. And you see a lot of incredibly damaging things that happen to people's health. It changes their whole dynamic and their whole lives. At the right. end, you see them happy and then you see them at the end. And there's a woman and she's in Anaheim and she has four kids and her husband, she said her husband ran away. She goes, my husband ran away. And I'm going to find, you know, I'm laying there, man, and I'm going to find her. And I'm going to give them some money so that they can not live day to day in a hotel.
Oh, George.
So it's like, I have to. I mean, I don't have to, but I have to because of who I am.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to save her because of what she is, but I've seen too many families like that growing up and I have to, you know, I don't know her, but I have to, I will.
I gotta hug you. I don't know. I'm
not sure if there was a right guy to have money. Like, you know, Anne would be like, you get that fucking guy. I said, yeah, I did. If
people are going to hear this and go, I got to write to George. I need money,
man. This lady, man, one time in San Francisco, man, we're at the Warfield and this lady comes over and she's old and dirty and she's got these fucking crooked glasses and she holds out her hand and it's dirty and she goes, spare change. And she's got her hand like this and she's got 3/4 and a dime. And I said, let me see what you got there. And it's all dirty. And I said, hold your hand out. I said, I took $100 bill and I said, here, now you have 185 cents. And she has her, I said, hold your hand out. Looking around and they're going like this. And I said, now you have 285 cents. I said, hold your hand out. Now you have 385 cents. Hold your hand out. We got to like 785 cents.
Oh, man.
And she lunges at me and she hugs me. She smells so fucking bad. And her head is right here and she's crying. I go, I know. And she's holding the money like this. And it's coming out of both sides. And I look around and all those guys are crying. It's in front of the Pinecrest Cafe right there on Pine and thing right by the Warfield. And she can't believe it. And through the tears, to the fucking glasses, and they turn around, everybody's crying, and they go, I've never seen anything like that. And I go, would you fuck her? I said, come on, let's go eat.
For 700 bucks.
So, I mean, you know, I know what it's like to have 85 cents.
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, I've given a lot of money away.
You know, it would have been cruel, and I'm glad you're not the kind of person. You could have said, you can keep that 700, or you could go for what's behind that curtain.
I know, man. No, I would never do that.
And what about these NFTs I'm reading about? How far in?
I'm just starting. I mean, I don't know, man. I think the intellectual property of it is what is getting people's attention. Is that it's something that's so unique that only one person can have it. But if you sell it, that person makes money every time they sell it. Like almost like, let's say that little Rodney Dangerfield thing back there. Right. Like if you said, Bob, I have an NFT and part of the NFT is you get my Rodney Dangerfield award. And people would be like, oh, fuck. So you get a Rodney, you get an NFT from you and then you get that. And then you get, so you own it. And there's only one and you own it. So I think that's, you know, that's what's getting people to go crazy about it. Cause it's almost like crypto, but it's like
right.
Bitcoin, but it's a piece of unique property.
We're bartering life.
We're bartering. Yeah. If you had a chair at your house or you could say, you know, I have Richard Pryor's chair at my house. You could say, well, I'll never do it, but I would say, you know, you could, my NFT would be a picture of me and Richard. And then you get the chair.
Right. I have the tip for my circumcision in
like that
in alcohol.
In a little,
it's better than an olive in a martini.
Eddie Van Halen had his hip bone in the freezer, the orb, and it said on it. Do not make soup.
What about your kidney? You're okay, right?
Yeah, I'm good.
You're healthy.
Yeah. Yep, I'm good.
And you have your ex-wife to thank, correct?
I do. You know, I'm very disingenuous to her, but not anymore. I mean, she saved my life.
Yeah, we go through phases. I have a wonderful ex-wife, and I have a new wife, which is not new. I mean, she's a grown-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's...
But, you know, we talked about that. Like, you know, you went back in, and you were very happy, Matt.
I have gotten very, very happy, and it's really kind of a miracle, because I had different girlfriends, but I 25 years divorced. I mean, I didn't think I'd ever find anybody again. Right.
That's a long time divorced.
It is a long time. I came close a couple times to being arrested. No, I came close to unusual mistakes that wouldn't have worked just because we weren't right. But
so, so Lopez versus Lopez now, like the first show got me through my childhood to the mother. Like when I described the first show, I would say, you know, he never had a father. He has to convince to his mom he's a man, and he has to convince his wife that he can be a dad when he didn't have one and a husband. So there's this kind of triangle thing.
Right.
And then in this one, you know, mine and I didn't talk for years, and it kills you. And then
I didn't know that. I didn't know you didn't talk for years.
And then Arsenio would say, "They come back, man." And I was like,
"That's true."
When?
I never lost mine. But and I'm very, very close with them. But it's hard. It's hard. Being a parent is hard.
Yeah.
But do you see your first thing? You're doing this show with her. This must be like full circle. And Bruce Helford.
I mean, and Debbie.
And Michael Rotenberg is your manager, who I've been friends with since we're both. I mean, I was 23 when I met the guy with Howie.
Yeah. Now you're like, life yeah,
it's that, all right? All the people that you are comfortable with.
You know, if it wasn't Bruce, you know, I would be like, okay, you know, I did the other one with Troy. I did one with Matt Williams, who's brilliant, you know?
Yeah.
And I would be like, you know, even before I remember I read for Matt for Home Improvement at the end of the day at Disney. And I thought, fuck, just seeing Matt Williams. So he had the sweater and all perfect tones of brown. And I thought if I could do the show, I would do it with either Matt or Bruce. And I've done two with both. And then the other one with Troy, man. It's like three of the best guys you ever want to do comedy with.
Yeah.
So if Bruce wasn't involved in this, I would still be excited. But knowing that this guy knew me when I was like zero experience as an actor or zero experience as a TV personality, mm-hmm. that, and he got me here, and to be able to do it with Mayan, who, you know, got into Second City, did Second City, and it's great that, you know, it's, man, what a world.
And it's NBC, and they are good to comedies when they fall in love with one. And it feels totally perfect to me. It just feels like it was like, absolutely, that's what they're doing.
It could be manifest destiny in a way, because I told Fred Silverman in an elevator that when he was the head of NBC, I would tell my friends that I was going to have a show on NBC. And he said, well, maybe one day you will. You're at ABC, but maybe you'll come over. You know, he wasn't there anymore. And I just had to tell him, because in the elevator, I go, hey, Fred Silverman, you know, I was dreamt about having a show on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is, man.
I'm excited for you. And I'm excited for her. I'm excited for the both of you. But what about when you think the dialogue should be this way and she thinks it should be that way? I want to be a fly on the wall for that.
We'll have to see. We'll have to see. Because I think they want me to be disrespectful to her in the first show. And I'm not going to do it. They want me to call her a bitch, and I'm not going to call her.
No. Well, that degrades who you are.
And they're like, well, we'll talk about it. And I'm like, well, we can talk about it, but I'm not going to do it.
You do it in your stand-up sometimes, but there's a reason for it.
I never said anything to her like that in real life when we were at our worst. And culturally, they'd leave the fucking show if I did that.
George, you've been setting an example for a long time. You know better. They'll be fine. They'll be fine with it.
Yeah.
They're not going to let you disrespect. You're all about respect.
Slut. No.
You dirty whore. Hey, sorry.
Do you still have your fucking guitar that cries?
It's in the garage.
Man, I tell everybody, I said, he would do While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and somehow he would turn this little thing and water would come out.
And a shampoo bottle.
Fucking killer, man.
I had a garden hose, and I cut holes in the hose, and it leaked all over my... The problem, George, is it worked in a room of maybe 100 or 150 people.
If you got further away...
I did it in Carnegie Hall opening for Gino Vanelli when I was 22. Nobody could see it.
Right.
Don't do close-up magic in Carnegie Hall.
You couldn't do it. Yeah, because as he would play, if you were close enough, you would see the water, and they just went crazy.
And my pants got wet, and I would say to some guy in the audience, my pants are wet, and it's your fault. That's what I would say.
Brilliant, man.
George, I am so happy to connect
with you. I love
you,
Bob. Seriously, man. I love you, dude. And you know,
I love you, too. And I'm going to hit you because I want to see you.
I don't even know. I think one of the things about this is I don't think anybody will know how long we've known each other and how much love we actually and our friendship with each other.
I have so much for you. And so we're going to see each other and we're going to maybe I'll meet you. I want to golf with you because I'm horrible.
Fuck yeah. I like dudes that are horrible.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, you know, for us only seeing us on occasions, but never spending that much time together. If we golfed and in that time, it would be time incredibly well spent.
Exactly. It'll be precious time.
Yeah.
Well, I love you.
Okay, Bobby. I love you too, brother.
And all the best, man.
Man, right on, dude.
I'll talk to you.
1 second.
George Lopez, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, dude. Thanks, Bobby.
That's George Lopez. You ever have a friend when you haven't talked to that friend in a long time? Some people go, younger people especially go, I haven't talked to that friend. Oh, I haven't talked to him in a week or a month. We're not friends anymore. Or it's sometimes, a couple years I haven't talked. I haven't talked with him. I guess it's about every 5 years we'll catch up. I have so much love for that man. And I'm sure many of you feel that way about him too. If you have not seen some of his specials, if you have not seen The Wall, which was live on HBO when he did it, and you got to go to Netflix and see We'll Do It for Half. You just have to see this. It's really pure. You see who he is, that he's about family, and how damn funny he is. You have to listen to his podcast, which is Oh My God, Hi. It's just really special because he is, it's not even what you would think it would be, and it's incredibly compelling. You want to see his dates, because he's going to be touring, go to georgelopez.com. And it's George. It's G-E-O-R-G-E, not J-O-R. I don't know why I'm bothering to tell you that. But he's going to be playing a lot of places. In November, he'll be in San Diego. And he's going to be in San Jose and Hard Rock in Florida and all through Texas, San Antonio. And then Vegas. He's at the Mirage a lot. It's not a residency, but he is booked up and he will sell out. So get on to the GeorgeLopez.com or just go to whatever, you know, Ticketmaster and check out tickets to see this man. He is an unbelievable stand-up, a really great person. And I'm so excited about Lopez versus Lopez with Maya and his daughter and them doing the show together. It just sounds really perfect. So when that thing comes out on NBC, gather around and get those ratings going so they cannot remove the show because he deserves everything. He is incredible humanitarian. Also on his website, you can check out his George Lopez Foundation and help out the people that he helps out. Lots of love to George Lopez. It's wonderful to do this first episode of my same podcast, but I've got George, who's also with All Things Comedy, and I'm just thrilled. So you know what you do. You know what you do. You rate, review, you subscribe. You can listen to this on Hatcher and Crutcher and Flinson and Blinces. No, you go to Spotify or you go Apple. I love Apple Podcasts. There'll be a whole link with all of them. There's a million places. Or go to my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/Bob Saget. And I am just sending you guys nothing but good thoughts right now. And that we get through all this stuff we're going through and we can enjoy comedy again. I have to think that way. I keep saying we're failing upward, but I have to believe that. And no matter what you believe, you have to get back to humanity and life in general. So I'm wishing you and your families lots of good health and a lot of happiness and sending out a lot of love. Thanks again to George Lopez.
I will see you and hear you. I won't hear nothing. I won't see nothing except for my guests. But I will talk to some of you because I'm going to call some of you again. So keep a lookout on Twitter or on Instagram stories. And I will tell you when I'm going to be calling you guys. You leave a message and all that stuff, and I'll call you back. And it'll be short calls. I'll tell you when it happens. Anyway, take care of yourselves. It's nice to be over here at ATC, which I call acting. That's what I call it. I'm not editing this out. So sorry. Some of these just don't land. Take care of yourselves, everybody. We'll be back next time with Bob Saget's Here For You. My name in a sentence. How incredibly awkward. All the best.